Disc 4. A time of peace was not a time of rest for the prophet. He put forward as an ideal that a third of each cycle of 24 hours should be for worship, a third for work, and a third for the family. This last third included the time spent in sleep and at meals. As to worship, much of it was done during the night. In addition to the evening and dawn prayers, they performed voluntary prayers after the same pattern. The Quran also enjoined long recitations of its own verses, and the Prophet recommended various litanies of repentance and praise. Lengthy night worship had been established as a norm by the first revelations, but the community which had received these had been a spiritual elect. Medina had also had its own initial elect of believers, but the rapid spread of Islam within recent years had made the elect something of a minority, and they are referred to as a group of those that are with thee in a verse which was now revealed to lessen the sense of obligation attached to long vigils. Verily thy Lord knoweth that thou keepest vigil well nigh 2/3 of the night, and sometimes half of it or a third of it, thou and a group of those that are with thee. God measureth the night and the day. He knoweth that ye will not be able to come up to the full measure of it, and therefore hath he relented unto you. Recite then even so much of the Quran as is easy for you. The elect of the companions nonetheless continued to pray much at night, of which the last third was mentioned by the Prophet as being especially blessed. Each night, when a third of it hath yet to come, our Lord, blessed and exalted be He, descendeth unto the nethermost heaven, and He saith, Who calleth unto me that I may answer him? Who prayeth unto me a prayer that I may grant him it? Who asketh my forgiveness that I may forgive him? It was also revealed about this time, in definition of the believers, they turn aside from their beds to invoke their Lord in fear and in longing, and of what we have given them they give. And no soul knoweth the hidden bliss that lieth in store for them as meed for that which they were wont to do. The equal distribution of the hours of the daily cycle between the three claims of worship, work, and the family could only be approximate. As regards family, the Prophet had no room of his own, and every evening he would move to the apartment of the wife whose turn it was to give him a home for the next 24 hours. During the day he had frequent visits from his daughters and from his aunt, Safiya, or he would visit them. Fatima would often bring her 2 sons to see him. Hassan was now nearly 1.5 years old, and the 8-month-old Hussein was already beginning to walk. The Prophet also loved his little granddaughter, Umama, who nearly always accompanied her mother, Zainab. Once or twice he brought her with him to the mosque, perched on his shoulder, and kept her there while he recited the verses of the Quran, putting her down before the inclination and prostrations, and restoring her to his shoulder when he resumed his upright position. Another loved one was the 15-year-old Usama, the son of Zaid and Ayman, very dear to the Prophet for the sake of both his parents and also for his own sake. As a grandson of the house, he was often to be found inside it or about its doors. Most afternoons, the Prophet would visit Abu Bakr, as he had done in Mecca. To some extent, the claims of family and of work coincided, for he often wished to talk with Abu Bakr about affairs of state, as he likewise did with Zaid and with his 2 sons-in-law, Ali and Uthman. But work was in danger of invading the Prophet's whole life, because no voice in all Medina could compare with his for solving a problem or answering a question or settling a dispute. Even those who did not believe him to be a prophet would seek his help if need be, unless they were too proud. In addition to what concerned the welfare of the community as a whole, both in its inward harmony and in its relations with the rest of Arabia and beyond, scarcely a day passed when his advice or help was not sought by one or more of the believers in connection with some purely personal problem, either material or spiritual. Such demands as these upon the Prophet's time were not to be avoided, but there was a growing need that he should be protected in other ways, and the protection that now came was not unconnected with the following altogether unexpected event, which served to emphasize his uniquely privileged position. It happened one day that he wanted to speak to Zayd about something and went to his house. Zayd was out, and Zainab, his wife, not expecting any visitors at that time, was lightly clad. But when she was told that the Prophet had come, she was so eager to greet him that she leaped to her feet and ran to the door to invite him to stay until Zayd returned. "He is not here, O Messenger of God," she said, "but come thou in. My father and my mother be thy ransom." As she stood in the doorway, a radiant figure of joyous welcome, the Prophet was amazed at her beauty. Deeply moved, he turned aside and murmured something which she could not grasp. All she heard clearly were his words of wonderment as he walked away. "Glory be to God the Infinite. Glory be to Him who disposeth men's hearts." When Zayd returned, she told him of the Prophet's visit and of the glorification she had heard him utter. Zayd immediately went to him and said, "I have been told thou camest unto my house. Why didst not enter, thou who art more to me than my father and my mother? Was it that Zainab hath found favour with thee? If it be so, I will leave her." "Keep thy wife and fear God," said the Prophet with some insistence. He had said on another occasion, "Of all things licit, the most hateful unto God is divorce." And when Zayd came again the next day with the same proposal, again the Prophet insisted that he should keep his wife. But the marriage between Zayd and Zainab had not been a happy one, and Zayd found it no longer tolerable, so by mutual agreement with Zainab he divorced her. This did not, however, make Zainab eligible as a wife for the Prophet, for although the Quran had only specified that men were forbidden to marry the wives of sons sprung from their loins, it was a strong social principle not to make a distinction between sons by birth and sons by adoption. Nor was the Prophet himself eligible, for he had already 4 wives, the most that the Islamic law allows. Some months passed, and then one day, when the Prophet was talking with one of his wives, the power of the revelation overwhelmed him. And when he came to himself, his first words were, "Who will go unto Zainab and tell her the good tidings, that God hath given her to me in marriage, even from heaven?" Salma was near at hand, Safiya's servant, who had long considered herself a member of the Prophet's household, and she went in haste to Zainab's house. When she heard the wonderful tidings, Zainab magnified God and threw herself down in prostration towards Mecca. Then she took off her anklets and bracelets of silver and gave them to Salma. Zainab was no longer young, being almost in her 40th year, but she had retained the appearance of youth. She was, moreover, a woman of great piety, who fasted much and kept long vigils and gave generously to the poor. As a skilled worker in leather, she could make shoes and other objects, and all that she earned in this way was for her a means of charity. There could be no question in her case of any formal wedding, for the marriage was announced in the revealed verses as a bond already contracted. "We have married her to thee." It remained for the bride to be brought to the bridegroom, and this was done without delay. The verses also said that in future adopted sons should be named after their fathers who begot them, and from that day Zayd was known as Zayd ibn Haritha instead of Zayd ibn Muhammad, as he had been called ever since his adoption some 35 years previously. But this change did not annul his adoption as such, nor did it affect in any way the love and the intimacy between the adopter and the adopted, who were now nearing their 60th and 50th years. It was merely a reminder that there was no blood relationship. And in this sense, the revelation continued, "Muhammad is not the father of any man amongst you, but he is the messenger of God and the seal of the prophets." At the same time, other revelations stressed the great difference between the Prophet and his followers. They were not to address him ever by his name, as they addressed each other. the permission which God had given him to have more than four wives was for him alone and not for the rest of the community. Moreover, his wives were given the title of the mothers of the faithful, and their status was such that it would be an enormity in the eyes of God if, having been married to the prophet, they should ever be given in marriage to another man. If the believers wished to ask a favour of one of them, for their intercession with the prophet was often sought, they must do so from behind a curtain. They were also told, O ye who have faith, enter not the dwellings of the prophet unto a meal, without waiting for its time to come, except if leave be given you. But if ye are invited, then enter, and when ye have fed, then disperse. Linger not in hope of discourse. Verily that would be irksome unto the prophet, and he would shrink from telling you, but God shrinketh not from the truth. Such precepts were necessary on account of the great love they bore him, and their desire to be in his presence as long and as often as possible. Those who were with him were always loath to leave him, nor could they have been blamed if they stayed, for when he spoke to anyone, he would turn to him so fully and make him so amply the object of his attention that the man might well imagine himself to be privileged enough for liberties which others dared not take. And when he took a man's hand, he was never the first to relinquish his hold. But while protecting the prophet, the revelation introduced at this time a new element into the liturgy, which made it possible for his people to give expression to their love and to benefit from his spiritual radiance without imposing unduly their presences upon him. Verily, God and his angels whelm in blessings the prophet. O ye who believe, invoke blessings upon him, and give him greetings of peace. And shortly afterwards the prophet told one of his companions, An angel came unto me, and said, None invoketh blessings upon thee once, but God invoketh blessings upon him tenfold. The preparations of Quraysh for a final attack on the prophet were brought to a head towards the end of the fifth year of Islam. It was about the new year of AD 627. Quraysh themselves and their closest allies were 4,000 strong. Together with one or two other contingents from the south, they were to march out from Mecca along the west coastal route to Medina, the same route which they had taken to Uhud. A second army, which was considerably less of a unity, was to close in on Medina from the east, that is, from the plain of Najd. Together, the two armies were estimated at a total of more than three times the strength of Quraysh at Uhud. There the Muslims had been defeated by a force of 3,000. What could they now hope to do against 10,000? Moreover, instead of a troop of only 200 horse, Quraysh had this time 300, and could rely on the Bedouins of Khatafan for another troop of the same strength. They marched forth from Mecca according to plan. And about the same time, possibly with the connivance of Abbas, a number of horsemen from the Bani Khuza'a set out with all speed for Medina to warn the prophet of the impending attack and to give him details of its strength. They reached him in 4 days, thus giving him only a week to make preparations. He at once alerted the whole oasis and spoke words of encouragement to his followers, promising them the victory if only they would have patience and fear God and obey orders. Then, as he had done at Uhud, he summoned them to a consultation, at which many opinions were expressed as to what would be the best plan of action. But finally, Salman al-Farisi rose to his feet, the Persian. That is what al-Farisi means, who had made contact with the prophet at Quba, and who had by now, thanks to the prophet, been able to buy himself free from slavery. O messenger of God, he said, In Persia, when we feared an attack of horse, we would surround ourselves with a trench, so let us dig a trench about us now. Everyone agreed to this plan with enthusiasm, the more so as they were averse to repeating the strategy of Uhud. Time was short, and all efforts would have to be strained to the utmost if no dangerous gap was to be left in the defences. The prophet made each section of his community responsible for a part of the trench, and he himself worked with them. They went out at dawn every day, immediately after the prayers, and came home at twilight. As he led them out on one of the first mornings, he chanted a reminder of their work at building the mosque. O God, no good is but the good hereafter. Forgive the helpers and the emigrants. It was immediately taken up by them all, and sometimes they chanted, O God, no life is but the life hereafter. Have mercy on the helpers and the emigrants. They continually reminded each other that the time was short. The enemy would soon be upon them, and if any man showed signs of flagging, he was at once an object of mockery. Salman, on the other hand, was an object of admiration, for he was not only very strong and able-bodied, but for years he had been used to digging and carrying. He doth the work of 10 men, they said, and a friendly rivalry started up between them. Salman is ours, the emigrants claimed. He is one of us, the helpers retorted. We have more right to him. But the prophet said, Salman is one of us, the people of the house. Despite the hardness of the work, there were moments of merriment. A convert from the Bani Damra, one of the people of the bench who lived in the mosque, was a man of considerable piety, but in looks he was not well favoured, and his parents had moreover given him the name Ju'el, which has the secondary meaning of little beetle. The prophet had recently changed this to the fine name of Amr, which means life, spiritual well-being, religion. The sight of the Damrite digging at the trench prompted one of the emigrants to a couplet. His name he changed Ju'el to Amr, gave the poor man that day his help. He repeated this to Amr, and those who overheard it took it up and made a song of it, not without laughter. The prophet joined in this only at the words Amr and help, which he pronounced each time with considerable emphasis. Then he led them into another song. Lord, but for thee we never had been guided, never had given alms nor prayed thy prayer. Send then serenity upon us, make firm our feet for the encounter. These foes oppressed us, sought to pervert us, but we refused. The prophet worked now with the emigrants and now with the helpers, sometimes with a pickaxe, sometimes with a shovel, and sometimes as a carrier. But wherever he might be, it was understood that he must be informed of any unusual difficulty. So it was that after many vain attempts to split or dislodge a rock he had struck, Umar went to the prophet, who took the pickaxe from him, and gave the rock a blow, at which a flare as of lightning flashed back over the city and towards the south. He gave it another blow, and again there was a flash, but in the direction of Uhud, and beyond it, towards the north. A third blow split the rock into fragments, and this time the light flashed eastwards. Asked for the significance of the flashes, the prophet said, By the light of the first I saw the castles of the Yemen. By the light of the second I saw the castles of Syria. By the light of the third I saw the white palace of Kisra at Madain. Through the first hath God opened unto me the Yemen. Through the second hath he opened unto me Syria and the west, and through the third the east. Scarcely had the trench been finished, it took them 6 days in all, when news came that the army of Quraysh were approaching down the valley of Akik and were now a little to the southwest of the town. All the outlying houses of the oasis had already been evacuated and their tenants housed within the defences. The prophet now gave orders for every woman and child to be allocated a place in one or other of the upper rooms of the fortresses. Then he encamped with his men, about 3,000 in all, on the chosen site. The Meccan army and their allies pitched separate camps not far from Uhud. Quraysh were dismayed to find that the crops of the oasis had already been harvested. Their camels would have to subsist on the acacias of the valley of Akik, but there was nothing for the horses except the fodder they had brought with them. It was therefore imperative to make an end of the enemy as quickly as possible, and with this intention the two armies joined together and advanced in the direction of the city. Abu Sufyan was commander-in-chief, Khalid and Ikrimah were again in command of the cavalry. As they approached, they were heartened to see the enemy camp in front of them outside the town. They had been afraid that they would find them garrisoned behind their battlements, but out in the open they should be able to overwhelm them by sheer weight of numbers. When they drew nearer, however, they were amazed to see that a broad trench lay between them and the archers, who were lined the whole way along it on its further side. Their horse would only be able to reach it with difficulty, and then would come the greater difficulty of crossing it. Even now a shower of arrows told them that they were already within range of the enemy. Khalid and Ikrimah examined the trench, albeit from a safer distance, to see where it might most easily be crossed. "This piece of trickery!" they exclaimed in exasperation. "Never have Arabs resorted to such a device. There must surely be with him a man of Persia." To their disappointment, they saw that the work had been all too well done, except for a short section which was slightly narrower than the rest, and this was closely guarded. One or two attempts to storm it were a total failure. Their horses had never seen anything like the trench, and manifested a strong aversion for it. This might change, but for the moment the fighting could be no more than an interchange of archery. The days passed, and the strain was very great, with Khalid and Ikrimah and their men ever seeking to take advantage of a moment of slackness. The Prophet exhorted the believers and promised them the victory if they were steadfast, and steadfast they remained, despite their initial weariness from the strain of overlong watches. The site of the camp had been well chosen, for the slope of the ground meant that the near bank was considerably higher than the far bank. Again and again the enemy tried to force their way across, but they could achieve nothing. The revelation referred to the strain of those days as the time when eyes could no longer look with steadiness, and when men's hearts rose up into their throats, and ye were thinking strange thoughts about God. There the believers were tested and tried, and their souls were quaked with a mighty quaking. The question arose in every mind as to how many more such days could be endured. Food was beginning to run short, and the nights were exceptionally cold, and many of the weak in faith, unnerved by hunger and cold and lack of sleep, were almost ready to join the hypocrites who were passing round the word that it was not possible to continue to resist such an enemy with only a trench between them, and that they should withdraw behind the city walls. The Prophet knew that in many souls amongst his people the powers of endurance were nearing their end. But he knew also that as each day went by, the enemy likewise felt the grip of hardship tighten upon them. Nearly 2 weeks had passed, and they had achieved nothing. The provisions of both their armies were running out, while more and more of their horses were dying every day, of hunger or of arrow wounds or of both. Some camels had also died. Nor could Quraysh fail to perceive that Ghatafan and the other Bedouin were at the best reluctant allies. They had taken part in the campaign far more in hopes of plunder than out of hostility to the new religion, and those hopes by which they had been lured to the Yathrib oasis had proved totally vain. Recriminations were on many tongues, and mutual distrust spread throughout the two invading armies. The expedition had virtually failed, and now the final seal of failure was placed upon it by heaven. For days the weather had been exceptionally cold and wet, and now a piercing wind came from the east with torrents of rain which forced every man to take shelter. The night fell, and a tempest raged over the plain. The wind rose to hurricane force, and what the wind did not accomplish was done by unseen hands. Throughout the two camps of the invaders there was soon not one tent left standing, nor any fire left burning, and the men crouched, shivering on the ground, huddled together for warmth. They spent the night benumbed with cold, and then towards dawn, when the wind began to abate, Abu Sufyan cried out in a loud voice, "Men of Quraysh, our horses and our camels are dying, and now we have suffered from the wind what your eyes behold. Therefore, begone from this place, for I am going." With these words he went to his camel and mounted it, so eager to set off that he forgot to untie its hobble, which he did only after he had forced it to rise on three legs. But Ikrimah said to him, "Thou art the head of the people and their leader. Wilt thou be clear of us so hastily and leave the men behind?" Whereupon Abu Sufyan was ashamed, and making his camel kneel once more, he dismounted. The army broke camp and moved off, and he waited until most of them were on the homeward march. Then he set off himself, having agreed with Khalid that he should bring up the rear with a detachment of 200 horse. In the Muslim camp, Bilal made the call to the dawn prayer, and when they had prayed it, the half-light of the approaching day revealed the total emptiness of the plain beyond the trench. The Prophet fasted Ramadan in Medina and remained there also during the month which followed. One night, towards its end, he dreamed that with his head shaved he entered the Kaaba and its key was in his hand. The next day he told his companions of this and invited them to perform the lesser pilgrimage with him, whereupon they hastily set about making preparations so that they could leave as soon as possible. Between them they purchased 70 camels to be sacrificed in the sacred precinct. Their meat would then be distributed among the poor of Mecca. The Prophet decided to take one of his wives with him, and when lots were cast, the lot fell to Salama. Each man took with him a sword, and what might be needed for hunting, but before they set off, Umar suggested that they should go fully armed. Quraysh, he said, might well take the opportunity of attacking them, despite the sacred month. But the Prophet refused, saying, "I will not carry arms. I have come forth for no end other than to make the pilgrimage." The Prophet was bareheaded and had already donned the age-old traditional pilgrim's dress of two pieces of unstitched cloth, one girt round the waist to cover the lower part of the body, and the other draped round the shoulders. He now consecrated himself for the pilgrimage, with two prayer cycles, after which he began to utter the pilgrim's cry, "Labbaik Allahumma Labbaik," which means, "Here I am at thy service, O God." Most of the others followed his example, but a few preferred to wait until they had advanced somewhat further upon their journey, for the pilgrimal state carried with it certain restrictions about hunting. When Quraysh heard of the departure of the pilgrims from Medina, they were filled with misgivings, as the Prophet had anticipated, and they immediately summoned a meeting in the assembly. Never had they known a more serious dilemma. If they, the guardians of the sanctuary, were to hinder the approach of over 1,000 Arab pilgrims to the Holy House, this would be a most flagrant violation of the laws on which all their own greatness was founded. On the other hand, if they allowed their enemies to enter Mecca in peace and comfort, it would be an immense moral triumph for Muhammad. The tidings of it would spread throughout Arabia and be on everybody's lips, and it would serve to place the crown of defeat upon their own recent unsuccessful attack upon Medina. Perhaps worst of all, these pilgrims' performances of the ancient rites would serve to make the new faith more attractive and to confirm its claim to be the religion of Abraham. All things considered, it was out of the question to let them come. "By God, this shall not be," they said, "so long as there is a single eye amongst us with a glimmer of life left in it." When the pilgrims reached Usfan, the scout who had been sent on ahead rejoined them with the news that Quraysh had sent Khalid with a troop of 200 horse to bar their approach. So the Prophet asked for a guide who could take them on by another way, and a man of Aslam led them a little towards the coast, and then by a devious and difficult path until they reached the pass which leads down to Hudaybiyah, an open tract of land below Mecca at the edge of the sacred territory. Their detour had kept them well out of sight of Khalid, but at one point, when it was too late for him to take up another position, they raised so much dust that he realized what had happened and galloped back to Mecca with his troop to warn Quraysh of their approach. The Prophet had chosen his favorite camel, Kaswa, for the pilgrimage, and at the end of the pass she stopped and knelt. The rocks resounded as many of the men cried out, "Hull! Hull!" which is what they say to make a camel rise, but she remained as if rooted to the earth. "Kaswa is stubborn," they said, but the prophet knew well that it was a sign that they should go no further than Hudaybiyah, at any rate for the moment. He said, referring to Quraysh, "They shall not ask of me this day any concession which honoureth the rights of God, but I will grant it them." Then he spoke to Kaswa, and she quickly rose to her feet and bore him down to the edge of Hudaybiyah, followed by the other pilgrims. Here he told them to camp. But there was almost no water, only the dregs of it at the bottom of one or two hollows, and the men were complaining of thirst. The prophet called Najah to him, the man of Aslam, who was in charge of the sacrificial camels, and told him to bring him a pail of as much water as he could from the largest of the hollows, which he did. Having performed his ablution, the prophet rinsed his mouth and spat back the water into the pail. Then, taking an arrow from his quiver, he said, "Go down with this water and pour it into the waters of the hollow. Then stir them with this arrow." Najah did as he was bid, and water, clear and fresh, surged up so quickly and so plentifully at the touch of the arrow that he was almost overwhelmed before he could clamber out. The pilgrims gathered round the edge of the hollow, and every man drank his fill, as did also the animals. Having satisfied their thirst, the pilgrims were soon able also to eat their fill, thanks to a gift of camels and sheep from two Bedouin chiefs, whose tribe, the Bani Kuzaha, one-time guardians of the sanctuary, included the clans of Aslam, Kaab, and Mustalik. To a man, these were now all well disposed towards the prophet. For such of them as had not yet entered Islam, there was a political advantage in this alliance, which was needed to counterbalance the pact that their great enemies, the Bani Bakr, had long had with Quraysh. For the moment there was no fighting between Kuzaha and Bakr, and Kuzaha were tolerated by Quraysh, but at the same time suspected. One of their leading men, Budail ibn Warqa, was in Mecca when news came that the pilgrims were encamped at Hudaybiyah. He now went with some of his clansmen to the prophet to inform him of the attitude of Quraysh. "They swear by God," he said, "that they will not leave the way open between thee and the house until the last of their fighting men hath perished." The prophet said, "We came not here for battle. We came only to make our pilgrimal rounds about the house. He that standeth in our way, him we shall fight. But I will grant them time, if they so desire it, to take their precautions and to leave the way clear for us." Budail and his fellows returned to Mecca, where he told of the peaceful intent of the pilgrims, and also that the prophet had said he was ready to give Quraysh time to prepare for their coming. Quraysh now sent Suhail to conclude a treaty, and with him were his two clansmen, Mikraz and Huwaitib. They conferred with the prophet, and the companions heard their voices rise and fall according to whether the point in question was hard to agree upon or easy. When they had finally reached an agreement, the prophet told Ali to write down the terms, beginning with the revealed words of consecration, "Bismillahirrahmanirrahim." In the name of God, the infinitely good, the all-merciful. But Suhail objected. "As to Rahman," he said, "I know not what he is. But write, 'Bismik Allahumma,' in thy name, O God, as thou wert wont to write." Some of the companions cried out, "By God, we will write naught but Bismillahirrahmanirrahim." But the prophet ignored them and said, "Write Bismik Allahumma." And he went on dictating, "These are the terms of the truce between Muhammad, the messenger of God, and Suhail, the son of Amr." But again Suhail protested. "If we knew thee to be the messenger of God," he said, "we would not have barred thee from the house, neither would we have fought thee. But write, 'Muhammad, the son of Abdullah. Ali had already written the messenger of God, and the prophet told him to strike out those words, but he said he could not. So the prophet told him to point with his finger to the words in question, and he himself struck them out. Then he told him to write in their place, the son of Abdullah, which he did. The document continued. They have agreed to lay down the burden of war for 10 years, in which times men shall be safe and not lay violent hands the one upon the other, on condition that whoso cometh unto Muhammad of Quraysh without the leave of his guardian, Muhammad shall return him unto them. But whoso cometh unto Quraysh of those who are with Muhammad, they shall not be returned. There shall be no subterfuge and no treachery, and whoso wisheth to enter into the bond and pact of Muhammad may do so, and whoso wisheth to enter the bond and pact of Quraysh may do so. The treaty ended with the words, Thou, Muhammad, shalt depart from us this present year, and shalt not enter Mecca when we are present in despite of us. But in the year that is to come, we shall go out from Mecca, and thou shalt enter it with thy companions, staying therein for 3 days, bearing no arms save the arms of the traveller, with swords in sheaths. In virtue of the prophet's vision, the companions had been certain of the success of their expedition. And when they heard the terms of the treaty, and realized that having reached the very edge of the sacred precinct, they must now return home with nothing accomplished, it was almost more than they could endure. But worse was to come. As they sat there in sullen and explosive silence, the clank of chains was heard, and a youth staggered into the camp with his feet in fetters. It was Abu Jandal, one of the younger sons of Suhail. His father had imprisoned him on account of his Islam, fearing that he would escape to Medina. His elder brother, Abdullah, was among the pilgrims and was about to welcome him when Suhail caught hold of the chain that was round his prisoner's neck and struck him violently in the face. Then he turned to the prophet and said, Our agreement was concluded before this man came to thee. That is true, said the prophet. Return him then unto us, said Suhail. O Muslims, shouted Abu Jandal at the top of his voice, am I to be returned unto the idolaters, for them to persecute me on account of my religion? The prophet took Suhail aside, and asked him as a favour to let his son go free. But Suhail implacably refused. His fellow envoys, Mikraz and Huwaitib, had been so far silent, but now, feeling that this incident was an inauspicious start for the truce, they intervened. O Muhammad, they said, we give him our protection on thy behalf. This meant that they would lodge him with them, away from his father, and they held to their promise. Be patient, Abu Jandal, said the prophet. God will surely give thee, and those with thee, relief and a way out. We have agreed on the terms of a truce with these people, and have given them our solemn pledge, even as they have done to us, and we will not now break our word. At this point Umar could no longer contain himself. Rising to his feet, he went to the prophet and said, Art thou not God's prophet? And he answered, Yea. Are we not in the right and our enemies in the wrong? He said. And again the prophet assented. Then why yield we in such lowly wise against the honour of our religion? Said Umar. Whereupon the prophet replied, I am God's messenger and I will not disobey him. He will give me the victory. But didst thou not tell us, persisted Umar, that we should go unto the house and make our rounds about it? Even so, said the prophet. But did I tell thee we should go to it this year? Umar conceded that he had not. Verily thou shalt go unto the house, said the prophet, and shalt make thy rounds about it. But Umar was still seething with indignation, and went to Abu Bakr to work off his feelings still further. He put to him exactly the same questions he had put to the prophet. But though Abu Bakr had not heard the answers, He gave him the same answer to each question, in almost exactly the same words. And at the end he added, "So cleave unto his stirrup, for by God he is right." This impressed Umar, and though his feelings had not yet subsided, he gave no further vent to them, and when the Prophet summoned him to put his name to the treaty, he signed it in silence. The Prophet also told Suhail's son, Abdullah, to put his name to it. Others of the Muslims who signed it were Ali, Abu Bakr, Abdurrahman ibn Auf, and Mahmud ibn Maslama. Some of the general bitterness seemed to have been smoothed over, but when Suhail and the others left the camp, taking with them the tearful Abu Jandal, men's souls were stirred up again. The Prophet was standing apart with those who had signed the document. He now left them and went towards the main body of the pilgrims. "Rise and sacrifice your animals," he said, "and shave your heads." Not a man moved, and he repeated it a second and a third time, but they simply looked at him in dazed and bewildered silence. It was not a rebellion on their part, but having had their expectations shattered by the turn of events, they were now genuinely perplexed by the command to do something which they knew to be ritually incorrect. For according to the tradition of Abraham, the sacrifices had to be performed within the sacred territory, and the same applied to the rite of shaving the head. Nonetheless, their apparent disobedience dismayed the Prophet, who withdrew to his tent and told Salama what had happened. "Go forth," she said, "and say no word to any man until thou hast performed thy sacrifice." So the Prophet went to the camel which he himself had consecrated and sacrificed it, saying in a loud voice so that the men could hear, "Bismillah, Allahu Akbar." At these words the men leaped to their feet and raced to make their sacrifices, falling over each other in their eagerness to obey. And when the Prophet called for a man to shave his head, many of the companions set about shaving each other's heads so vigorously that Salama was afraid, as she afterwards remarked, that mortal wounds might be inflicted. But some of them merely cut locks of their hair, knowing that this was traditionally acceptable as a substitute. Meantime, the Prophet had retired to his tent, and when the rite had been accomplished, he stood at the entrance with shaven scalp and said, "God have mercy on the shavers of their heads." Whereupon those who had cut their hair protested, "And on the cutters of their hair, O Messenger of God." But the Prophet repeated what he had said at first, and the voices were raised in protest still louder. Then, after another repetition and a third thunderous protest, he added, "And upon the cutters of their hair." When asked afterwards why he had first of all prayed only for the shavers of their heads, he answered, "Because they doubted not." Returning to his tent, the Prophet gathered up his luxuriant black hair from the ground and threw it over a nearby mimosa tree, whereupon the men crowded round, each bent on taking what he could for its blessing. The earth of the camp was strewn with the hair of the pilgrims, but suddenly there came a powerful gust of wind which lifted the hair from the ground and blew it towards Mecca, into the sacred territory. And everyone rejoiced, taking it as a sign that their pilgrimage had been accepted by God in virtue of their intentions, and they now understood why the Prophet had told them to perform their sacrifices. After they had set off on the return journey to Medina, Umar's conscience began to trouble him, and his anxiety was greatly increased when he rode up to the Prophet, seeking to enter into conversation with him, and the Prophet, so it seemed to him, was markedly distant and reserved. Umar rode on ahead, saying to himself, "O Umar, let thy mother now mourn her son." He said afterwards that he was so troubled for having questioned the wisdom of the Prophet that he feared there would be a special revelation condemning him. His fears reached their height when he heard behind him the hooves of a galloping horse, and the rider summoned him back to the Prophet. but his troubles vanished in an instant when he saw the prophet's face radiant with joy. "There hath descended upon me a surah," he said, "which is dearer to me than aught else beneath the sun." The new revelation left no doubt that the expedition from which they were now returning must be considered as a victorious one, for it opened with the words, "Verily we have given thee a clear victory." In the month which followed the treaty, Aisha suffered a great loss, which was shortly to be followed by cause for great rejoicing. Her mother, Umm Ruman, fell ill and died. She was buried in the Baqi, and the Prophet prayed over her. Inevitably, the news of her death was brought to Mecca and came to the ears of her son, Abd al-Kaaba, and it is possible that his bereavement prompted him to take an action which he had no doubt been contemplating for some time. However that may be, it was not long after his mother's death that he came to Medina and entered Islam. When he pledged his allegiance, the Prophet changed his name to Abd al-Rahman. Nor was he the only new Muslim at this time. As the weeks and the months passed, it became more and more apparent why the Quran had declared the truce to be a victory. The men of Mecca and Medina could now meet in peace and converse freely together. And during the next 2 years, the community of Islam was more than doubled. Soon after the return of the pilgrims, a verse had been revealed at which everyone rejoiced. "It may be that God will establish love between you and those with whom ye are at enmity." These words seemed to refer in general to the many conversions which now took place, but they were also taken by some to refer in particular to an unexpected close relationship which was now to be established between the Prophet and one of the leaders of Quraysh. A few months before Hudaybiyah, news had come from Abyssinia of the death of Ubayd Allah ibn Jash, the Prophet's cousin and brother-in-law. He had been a Christian before he entered Islam, and not long after his emigration to Abyssinia, he had reverted to Christianity. This had greatly distressed his wife, Habiba, Abu Sufyan's daughter, who remained a Muslim. And when 4 months had elapsed after the death of her husband, the Prophet sent a message to the Negus, the ruler of Abyssinia, asking him to stand proxy for himself and to ratify a marriage between him and the widow, if she were willing. To her the Prophet sent no message directly, but she had a dream in which someone came to her and addressed her as Mother of the Faithful, and she interpreted this as meaning that she would become the wife of the Prophet. The next day she received the message from the Negus which confirmed her dream, whereupon she chose her kinsman, Khalid ibn Sa'id, to give her in marriage, and he and the Negus solemnized the pact between them in the presence of Ja'far and others of the brethren. Then the Negus held a wedding feast in his palace, and all the Muslims were invited. The Prophet had also sent word to Ja'far that it would please him if he and his community would now come to live in Medina. Ja'far forthwith set about making preparations for the journey, and the Negus gave them 2 boats. It was decided that Habiba should travel with them. And in Medina, work was begun on the building of an apartment for her, next to those of the other wives. The Negus was not the only reigning prince to whom the Prophet sent a letter at this time. When he had split the seemingly invincible rock in the trench, he had seen the castles of the Yemen by the light which had flared from it at his first blow, whereas by the light which flared from his third and final blow, he had seen the white palace of Khusroz at Madain. As to the certainty which had then been given him about the future spread of the Empire of Islam, there was a connection between these 2 lights, inasmuch as the Yemen was now under the rule of Persia. And the Prophet was moved to write to the Persian monarch, informing him of his prophethood and summoning him to Islam. He may not have had much hopes of the success of his message, but it was necessary to offer him the possibility of making the right choice before any other action was taken. As to the second of the 3 lights, it had revealed the castles of Syria, and the Prophet had received from it the certainty of the spread of Islam to those parts and also to the West. In due course he was to send a similar letter to Heraclius, the Roman emperor, and he now dictated another such letter, which he sent to Alexandria, to the Mukaukis, the ruler of Egypt. Meantime, Khusroes had heard from other sources of the growing power of the Arab king of Yathrib, who claimed to be a prophet. So he dispatched an order to Bardan, his viceroy in the Yemen, asking for further and clearer information about Muhammad. Bardan forthwith sent two envoys to Medina so that they could see for themselves and bring him back news. Following a fashion that was prevalent at the Persian court, they had shaved their beards and grown long moustaches. Their appearance was abhorrent to the Prophet. "Who bade you do this?" he exclaimed. "Our lord," they said, meaning Khusroes. "My lord," said the Prophet, "hath bidden me grow my beard and cut short my moustache." He sent them away, telling them to return to him the next day. That night, Gabriel told him that on the same day there had been an uprising in Persia, in which Khusroes had been killed, and his son now reigned in his stead. So when the envoys returned, he told them of this, and bade them inform their master, the viceroy. Then he said, "Tell him that my religion and mine empire will reach far beyond the kingdom of Khusroes. And say unto him from me, Enter Islam, and I will confirm thee in what thou hast, and I will appoint thee king over thy people in the Yemen." They returned to Sana'a, not knowing what to think, and delivered the message to Bardan, who said, "We will see what befalleth. If what he said be true, then is he a prophet whom God hath sent." But even before he had had time to send a man to Persia to find out the truth of the matter, a messenger arrived from Siroz, the new Shah, announcing what had happened and claiming their allegiance. Instead of replying, Bardan entered Islam, and so did his two messengers and other Persians who were with him. He then sent word to Medina, and the Prophet confirmed his rule over the Yemen. That was the beginning of the fulfillment of what had been revealed in the first flash of light from the trench. The Prophet's letter reached Mada'in after the death of Khusroes, so it was delivered to his successor, whose sole answer was to tear it in pieces. "Even so, O Lord, tear from him his kingdom," said the Prophet when he heard of this. Ja'far and his companions now arrived at the end of their journey. He had left for Abyssinia at the age of 27 and was now a man of 40. He had not seen the Prophet for 13 years, though they had been in constant communication. The Prophet clasped him to him and kissed him between the eyes. With Ja'far was his wife Asma and their three sons Abdullah, Muhammad and Aun, who had been born in Abyssinia. With him also was Habiba, whose apartment was ready to receive her, and a second marriage feast was held to celebrate her union with the Prophet. She was now about 35 years old. The other wives, all except Aisha, had known her before. She was the sister-in-law of Zainab, and Sauda and Salama had been her close companions in their early days together in Abyssinia. Her coming had been expected and caused little stir. An object of much greater concern to the wives was the unexpected addition to their household of another wife, the young and beautiful Jewess, Safiya. Hearing of her beauty, Aisha sent to Salama to ask her about their new companion. "She is beautiful indeed," said Salama, "and the messenger of God loveth her much." Aisha went to the house where she was lodged, and entered with the throng of women who were visiting the new bride. She herself was veiled, and without revealing her identity, she remained somewhat in the background, but close enough to see for herself that what Salama had said was true. Then she left the house, but the Prophet, who was there, had recognized her, and following her out, he said, "O Aisha, how didst thou find her?" "I saw in her," said Aisha, a Jewess like any other Jewess? Say not so, said the prophet, for she hath entered Islam and made good her Islam. Of all the wives, Safiya was the nearest in age to Aisha, nearer even than Hafsa, the daughter of Umar, who was now 22. This had increased Aisha's fears at first, but as the weeks passed, the two youngest wives found a certain sympathy for each other, and Hafsa likewise befriended the newcomer. We were two groups, said Aisha in after years, in one myself and Hafsa and Safiya and Sauda, and in the other Salama and the rest of the wives. Aisha was at that time in her 16th year, old for her age in some respects, but not in others. Her feelings were always clear from her face, and nearly always from her tongue. On one occasion the prophet said to her, O Aisha, it is not hidden from me when thou art angered against me, nor yet when thou art pleased. O dearer than my father and my mother, she said, how knowest thou that? When thou art pleased, he said, thou sayest in swearing, Nay, by the Lord of Muhammad. But when thou art angered, it is, Nay, by the Lord of Abraham. On another occasion, when the prophet came to her somewhat later than she had expected, she said to him, Where hast thou been this day until now? O little fair one, he said, I have been with Salama. Hast thou not had thy fill of Salama? She said. And when he smiled without answering, she added, O messenger of God, tell me of thyself. If thou wert between the two slopes of a valley, one of which had not been grazed, whereas the other had been grazed, on which wouldst thou pasture thy flocks? On that which had not been grazed, said the prophet. Even so, she said, and I am not as any other of thy wives. Every woman of them had a husband before thee, except myself. The prophet smiled and said nothing. Aisha knew well that she could not have the prophet for herself alone. She was one woman, and he was as 20 men. The revelation had said of him, Verily, of an immense magnitude is thy nature. It was as if he were a whole world in himself, comparable to the outer world, and in some ways mysteriously one with it. She had often noticed that if there was a roll of thunder even in the distance, his face would change colour. The sound of a powerful gust of wind would likewise visibly move him. And on at least one occasion, when there was a downpour of rain, he bared his head and shoulders and breast, and went out into the open, so that he might share the delight of the earth in receiving the bounty of heaven directly upon his skin. Aisha was not any the less jealous by reason of his difference from other men, but she knew that jealousy, unlike love, was for this life only. Speaking of paradise, the revelation had promised more than once, and we remove whatever there may be of rancor in their breasts. One day she said to the prophet, O messenger of God, who are thy wives in paradise? Thou art of them, he said, and she treasured these words for the rest of her life, as also his having said to her once, Gabriel is here, and he giveth thee his greetings of peace. Peace be upon him, and the mercy of God and his blessings, she had answered. Of her jealousy, she would say in after years, I was not jealous of any other wife of the prophet, as I was jealous of Khadija, for his constant mentioning of her, and because God had bidden him give her good tidings of a mansion in paradise of precious stones. And whensoever he sacrificed a sheep, he would send a goodly portion of it unto those who had been her intimate friends. Many a time said I unto him, It is as if there had never been any other woman in the world, save only Khadija. Sauda, now grown somewhat elderly, gave her day with the prophet to Aisha, because she felt sure that this would greatly please him. And the rest of the community, including the other wives, had no doubt that of those wives now living, it was Aisha that the prophet loved most. This was not mere conjecture, since from time to time, by one or another of his companions, he would be asked the question, "O messenger of God, whom lovest thou most in all the world?" And although he did not always give the same answer to this question, inasmuch as he felt great love in more than one direction, for his daughters and their children, for Ali, for Abu Bakr, for Zayd and Usama, the answer was sometimes Aisha, but never one of the other wives. For this reason, it was becoming the custom in Medina that if a man had a favour to ask of the Prophet, and if he was offering him a gift with a view to his petition as the Quran recommended, he would postpone the offering until the Prophet was in Aisha's apartment, on the assumption that he was then at his happiest, and therefore at his readiest to grant favour. This caused ill feeling in the household of the Prophet, and Salama went to him on behalf of herself and the others, asking him to make an announcement that anyone wishing to give him a present should do so without waiting until it was his day to be in a particular house. The Prophet did not answer her, and she asked him a second time, and again he remained silent. Then she asked him a third time, and he said, "Trouble me not with regard unto Aisha, for verily the revelation cometh not unto me when I am beneath the coverlet of a wife, except that wife be Aisha." Salama said, "I repent unto God for my having troubled thee." But others of the wives were not content to stop there, and they sent to his daughter Fatima, and asked her to intervene on their behalf, and to say to him, "Thy wives adjure thee by God to give them justice in respect of the daughter of Abu Bakr." Fatima reluctantly agreed to this, but put off doing it for some days, until finally her cousin Zainab, the daughter of Jash, came to her and insisted. So she went to her father and said what she had been asked to say. "My little daughter," said the Prophet, "lovest thou not what I love?" And when she assented, he said, "Then love her," meaning Aisha. Then he said, "It was Zainab who sent thee, was it not?"
"Zainab and the others," said Fatima.
"I swear," said the Prophet, "it was she who set this afoot." And when Fatima admitted it, he smiled. She returned to the wives and recounted what had happened.
"O daughter of God's messenger," they said, "thou hast availed us nothing." They pressed her to go a second time, but she refused. So they said to Zainab, "Go thou." And she went to the Prophet, who finally told Aisha to speak to her, and she produced arguments against which Zainab could say nothing. The Prophet was bound to be just and equitable towards his wives, and to encourage others to follow his example. But he was not responsible for the equity of others towards his own wives, nor would his sensitivity have allowed him to interfere. It was for him to receive a present with thanks, and to leave all else to the donor. When Zainab had gone, he said to Aisha, "Thou art indeed the daughter of Abu Bakr." Jealousy was inevitable in the Prophet's household, and he did his best to make light of it. Once he came into a room where his wives and others of his family were assembled, and in his hand was an onyx necklace which had just been given him. Holding it out to them, he said, "I shall give this unto her whom I love best of all." Some of the wives began to whisper wryly to each other, "He will give it to the daughter of Abu Bakr." But when he had kept them long enough in suspense, he called his little granddaughter, Umama, to him, and clasped it round her neck. The Prophet now stayed in Medina for 9 months. Despite lesser campaigns, the truce to the south made these months a time of relative peace and prosperity, though the wealth which had been won gave rise also to certain problems. Umar came one morning to the house of the messenger, and as he approached he heard the sound of women's voices raised to a pitch which he considered to be unseemly in the prophetic presence. The women were moreover of Quraysh, that is, of the emigrants, which confirmed his opinion that they were learning bad ways from the women of Medina, who for generations had been less restrained and more self-assertive than the women of Mecca. The Prophet hated to refuse a request, as well they knew, and they were now asking him with some insistence to give them various garments which had come to him as part of his fifth in the spoils of war. There was a curtain spread across part of the room, and when Umar's voice was heard asking permission to enter, there was a sudden total silence, and the women hid themselves behind the curtain with such speed that he entered to find the Prophet speechless with laughter. "May God fill thy life with laughter, O Messenger of God," he said. "Wondrous it was," said the Prophet, "how these women who were with me even now, how speedily upon hearing thy voice they were gone behind that curtain. It is rather thy right, not mine, that they should stand in awe of thee, not of me," said Umar. Then addressing the women, he said, "O enemies of yourselves, fear ye me and fear ye not God's messenger?" "It is even so," they said, "for thou art rougher and harsher than God's messenger." "That is true, O son of Khattab," said the Prophet. Then he added, "By him in whose hand is my soul, if Satan found that thou wert travelling upon a certain path, he would choose to go himself by any other path but thine." The newly won wealth and the consequent easing of the situation encouraged even Ayman to ask the Prophet for a favour. She had long felt the need of a camel that she could call her own, and now she went to him and asked him to give her a mount. He looked at her seriously and said, "I will mount thee on the child of a camel." "O Messenger of God," she exclaimed, thinking that he meant a calf, "that is not meat for me. I want it not."
"I will not mount thee," he said, "save on the child of a camel." And so the altercation continued until a smile on the Prophet's face made her realize that he was teasing her, and that every camel is necessarily the child of a camel. On another day, however, Umar found the Prophet in less good humour, with his head resting on his hand, which was against his cheek. "O Umar," he said, "they ask of me that which I have not." He had said previously, speaking of the increase of riches that promised conquests would bring to Medina, "It will not be good for you." It was as he had said, and this applied to his own household as well as to others. Until then, the Prophet and his family had lived a life of the utmost frugality. Aisha said that she had not known what it was to eat her fill of dates. Such was the poverty of their ever-increasing dependence that the Prophet's wives had only asked him for what they needed, and not always that. Things that could be dispensed with were given away, or else sold, so that the money could be charitably spent. But the Prophet now had the pleasure of giving presents to his wives, and they, for their part, were not slow in learning to ask for more, which sometimes created problems, because equity demanded that what was given to one must be given to all. At the same time, they began to take advantage of his indulgence in other ways. One day, Umar rebuked his wife for something, and she sharply answered him back. And when he expostulated with her, she replied that the wives of the Prophet were in the habit of answering him back, so why should she not do the same? "And there is one of them," she added, meaning their daughter, "who speaketh unto him her mind unabashed from morn till night." Greatly troubled by this, Umar went to Hafsa, who did not deny that what her mother had said was true. "Thou hast neither the grace of Aisha nor the beauty of Zainab," he said, hoping to shake her self-confidence. And when these words seemed to have no effect, he added, "Art thou so sure that if thou angerest the Prophet, God will not destroy thee in his anger?" Then he went to his cousin, Salama, and said, "Is it true that ye speak your minds unto God's messenger, and answer him without respect?"
"By all that is wonderful," said Salama, "what call hast thou to come between God's messenger and his wives? Yea, by God, we speak unto him our minds, and if he suffer us to do so, that is his affair, and if he forbid us, he will find us more obedient unto him than we are unto thee."
Umar felt that he had gone too far, and that the reproof was just. but there could be no doubt that all was not well in the prophet's household. The relatively sudden redress which now took place was partly due to an altogether unexpected event. The prophet's letter to the Mukakis, summoning him to Islam, was answered evasively. But with his answer, the ruler of Egypt sent a rich present of 1,000 measures of gold, 20 robes of fine cloth, a mule, a she-ass, and, as the crown of the gift, 2 Coptic Christian slave girls, escorted by an elderly eunuch. The girls were sisters, Maria and Cyrene, and both were beautiful. But Maria was exceptionally so, and the prophet marvelled at her beauty. He gave Cyrene to Hassan ibn Thabit and lodged Maria in the nearby house where Sophia had lived before her apartment adjoining the mosque was built. There he would visit her, both by day and by night. But his wives became so openly jealous that she was unhappy, and he then lodged her in Upper Medina. Aisha and the others were at first relieved, but they soon found that they had gained nothing, for the prophet did not visit Maria any the less often, and the added distance meant that his absences were even longer than before. They well knew that he was altogether within his rights, rights which had been recognized from the time of Abraham and before. Were they not all, except Sophia, descended from the union of Abraham with the bondmaid Hagar? Moreover, the law revealed to Moses had corroborated such rights, and the Quran itself expressly allowed a master to take his bondmaid as concubine on condition of her free consent. But the wives also knew that the prophet was exceedingly sensitive, and they saw to it that his whole domestic life was now penetrated by their deliberately undisguised reactions. In particular, Hafsa gave vent to such feeling that the prophet was finally induced to swear that he would not see Maria again, and Aisha was Hafsa's accomplice on this occasion.